Why write a book about the workers' movement in the present time? Do you feel that the state of Canadian labor is unique right now?
Well, the reason that I wrote this book was because I felt that there was a real need to try to spark more discussion about the state of the workers' movement, and I didn't see that happening, so I figured I would take a stab at it and see if it could, throw a rock in the pond and get some discussion going, because I think we're in a very, very serious situation for working people and for the organizations that working people have created. And there are some very critical issues that we're facing that often aren't discussed by the people who tend to write and speak in a pro-labor way.
Can you expand on why you feel we're in a serious situation?
Well, we're in, a global economic crisis, a global slump, which is moving now probably into a new recession after there was the recession in 2008, 2009, and after that, the beginning of an attack on the public sector, which we're only in the early stages of, and I think there's a significant possibility of major recession in North America, Europe, and potentially in China, which would mean for the world economy as a whole a real downturn. And so this is just, for ordinary people, this is people's lives, it's going to mean a deepening of the attacks on people's living standards and an acceleration of the ecological crisis. So I think the deteriorating state of the world means more attacks on unions and on other organizations that working people have created, and bigger challenges in terms of organizing for defending ourselves against those kinds of attacks. And I think that, to make a broad generalization, I think that very few workers' organizations are well positioned to take on even defensive fights successfully right now. So I think we're in a very dangerous situation that way.
Well, on that, how would you then assess the strength, I guess, of the Canadian labor movement today?
Well, see, on the one hand, with roughly 3 in 10 wage earners covered by a union collective agreement, a contract, I figure it's much higher than it is in the U.S., where it's down around 12%. That's a good thing. Obviously, the fact is that a significant minority of wage earners don't have to negotiate one-on-one with their employers. At least their basic wages and working conditions, to some extent, are regulated by a collective agreement, which means somewhat less competition among people and generally better wages and working conditions. But often people just leave it at that, and that is a very, very incomplete way of understanding the situation, because it doesn't actually look at what are the capacities of unions as organizations of the working class. To what extent are working people able to use organizations like these to defend themselves and to advance their interests and to fight for social change? And there, I think, we're in a much worse position than the percentage of workers in unions, which is called the union density rate, would suggest, in that we have these institutions that may be fairly stable. We haven't seen the number of people in unions going down in Canada. The percentage of people in unions has been slightly declining because unions haven't been growing as fast as the workforce has been growing. But the absolute numbers of people who are unionized has not been declining the way it has been in, say, the U.S. But, again, that's only one part of the problem. When you look at issues like, how many people are involved, how much democratic control do people have over their organizations, what kind of activities do unions organize, what's their relationship to other organizations in the community. There, I think we're in a much worse position, and unions are, I think, becoming harder for working people to use to fight back.
I know you write extensively about this in your book, but I'm wondering if you can summarize why you feel the union movement isn't growing rapidly, to coincide with the growth of the workforce.
Okay, so on the one hand, you have real offensive by employers to keep unions out, where jobs are being created in the private sector. So that's lots of jobs that have been created in both call centers and factories and offices, all sorts of different kinds, and unions haven't succeeded in making any inroads there, any significant inroads, and so that's resulted in a decrease in unionization. And of course, some of the jobs in traditionally highly unionized sectors like manufacturing and transportation have been lost through economic restructuring in the age of neoliberalism. So that's had an impact as well. And unions are faced with, you know, pretty significant offensive by employers and by governments, and are often just in reactive mode, trying to defend what they've got, rather than actually trying to think about responding in a more proactive, strategic way. And it's difficult when unions are often so distant from the workers that are their, you know, their membership. When unions are often union leaderships are negotiating concessions and accepting employer demands for givebacks, that's going to not give unions the best kind of reputation within the working class as a whole. There's an old slogan, an old saying, you don't need a union to go backwards. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, when unions go backwards, particularly when they give concessions without a fight, that's going to make them a lot less attractive to other people who aren't in unions. And even, unfortunately, when unions that are well-prepared and well-organized and relatively militant and democratic, like the postal workers, when they do take on a struggle, as the postal workers union did earlier this summer, and they lose, despite their best efforts, then, again, it's not going to send a signal to a lot of working people that, hey, I should take the risk to try to unionize my workplace. So this is the problem. As the situation, as the balance of forces gets worse and as unions become less effective, their appeal to non-unionized workers decreases, and that puts them in an even weaker position.
Mm-hmm. Well, in terms of one battle that was lost, you wrote about the city workers in Toronto that went on strike in 2009, and you point to it as a key battle that was lost, and I'm wondering why you thought this battle was lost and what lessons can be learned from it.
Okay, so yeah, I'm glad you bring that up, because for people in Toronto, it was a really, I think, a pivotal strike. It was lost because the union leadership kind of sleepwalking. They stumbled into a strike they didn't expect, because they figured that, having been big friends of former Mayor David Miller and his administration, that they wouldn't be in a situation where they'd be on mm-hmm. strike. It's that same regime. Unfortunately, most of the labor leadership in Toronto really thought that Miller was the thing, and then were, you know, the leaders of QP79 and 416, the two big municipal workers unions, were part of that, and so they were not prepared. And these are unions that have a history of very low levels of membership participation, very top down approaches by their leaderships, and, you know, very little effort to try to mobilize, in fact, active opposition to left activists and people who've tried to mobilize and be more militant democratic in their approach. And these unions also, then when they ended up in this strike trying to fend off concession demands from the employer, didn't have a way of understanding and acting on that understanding, that pitched this as about a defense of decent jobs as opposed to simply defending their own members. Mm-hmm. And in a time when there are fewer and fewer good jobs, there's the risk that when unionized workers defend what they have won through past efforts, things that they're defending that other working people don't have, there's the risk that in an age of falling expectations, corporate media and others will be able to get those people who are not unionized to blame those who are mm-hmm. for hanging on to what they've got. And then if you add in the fact that you have a Toronto, a situation where the majority of the working class is people of color, and disproportionately positioned in the worst portions of the job market, and here you have a union which doesn't really relate to a lot of those experiences, defending the better jobs in a kind of narrow way, the potential for a real backlash was there. And unfortunately, again, the union leadership kind of walked right into it, because instead of saying we're defending these jobs because we think that everyone deserves a good job, and we're not going to make this a better place to live by having fewer good jobs, and by explaining how, you know, decent jobs in rec centers and at City Hall and in lots of other places are good things, and we need more of them, that kind of a broader approach, and by not being, because they don't have a history of working with other organizations in the community, they couldn't build on those to make this part of a broader struggle in reality, not just as a rhetorical thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think this really set them up for being pilloried. And in terms of their own members, you had huge numbers of people, thousands and thousands of members who were on strike, but the leadership had done virtually nothing to explain to people what the issues were, why mm-hmm. they were taking a strong position against concessions. Once people were on picket lines, they didn't try to bring people together to feel a sense of their collective power. I have a friend who was working in a suburban part of the Greater Toronto area, and he described just day after day being on the picket lines with absolutely no sense of being part of something broader or connected to other workers. It never attempts to bring people together for mass marches or rallies. So it was very demoralizing for the actual strikers. So instead of those people being enthusiastic communicators with their neneighbors and their family members and their, other people there in their lives about the issues of the strike, those people probably just communicated a dispirited message. So it really hampered the ability to work at the grassroots to shift the understanding of what this was about. And so eventually they were able to beat back a lot of the employers' demands for concessions, but I think at the end of the day, in fact, the public sector workers were more, these municipal public sector workers were actually more distanced and alienated from other working people than they were before, and the right wing had really won the battle of ideas on this, and by pitching these people as narrow and self-interested and defending special privileges that they didn't deserve.
And do you think that battle of ideas led to the election of Rob Ford and now the sort of era of service cuts in City of Toronto?
I think there's a direct connection. I don't think we can say that the city of Toronto strike in 2009 caused the election of Ford, because there are other things that were going on, but I think it certainly contributed to it. It fed into a political climate which was hostile to the public sector in general and public sector workers. And so, of course, this shows how an ineffective strategy by those municipal public sector unions has helped actually put these unions in a really worse position under Ford, who's now intent on actually slashing services and jobs. But also, of course, that affects people throughout the city, as we know.
Mm-hmm. Well, your book was published right when there were some key strikes and lockouts happening with both Air Canada and then the lockout of CUPW. And many are predicting there's another strike that started today with OPSU and the colleges. And so many are predicting more job actions will continue to grow. So do you think the growth of job actions and strikes, during an age of austerity with, conservative governments could be a positive thing and galvanize, workers more?
Well, I think it's positive when faced with concessions, workers decide to draw the line and say, we're not going backward anymore. That's definitely a good thing. When most of the strikes that are taking place, strikes and lockouts, are exactly those, defensive strikes, where people are trying to prevent the situation from getting worse than it already is. But we have to put that into context, because the actual level of strikes is extremely low. There are a couple of high-profile ones, particularly the Air Canada strike, which was very short, and then the postal workers' rotating strikes turned into pan-Canadian lockout. Those are because those were federal jurisdictions, workers who were working across the whole Canadian state. That gave them a real profile in the media. But if you actually look at the number of strikes right now is as low as it's been since the mid-1950s, and that was at a time when the workforce was much smaller. So proportionally, fewer strikes, but the absolute number, the lowest since the mid-50s. And another way of looking at it is if you look at the amount of time that's spent on strike as a percentage of all time that gets worked in the country, it's at the lowest level it's been since the years 1938 to 1940, so at the very tail end of the Great Depression. So the overall prevalence of strikes is very low. It's very worrying considering how aggressive employers are being, that in so few situations workers are prepared to draw the line. Often, I think unionized workers are agreeing to poor deals because they feel that the alternative is a strike or a lockout where they'll end up worse off. But there's always the possibility that when people actually do say, we're not going to give back anymore, and take a stand, there's always the possibility to win. There's always the possibility that people will be able to organize collectively in ways which begin to change them, to give them an appreciation of collective power, that it is possible to take collective action and make a difference in the world, that we're not just forced to endure what governments and employers, you know, and others do to us as individuals. And most people, most of the time, just try to think about, you know, how can I get by? How can I and my family get by day to day, month by month, you know, in an individual kind of way? At least a strike or some other kind of mobilization is an opportunity for collective action. And so, you know, I gather that one of the issues in this college strike, that's just the college support staff workers strike in Ontario, is attempt to resist employer concessions, which include the demand for a longer probation period. Mm-hmm. So that I believe, I haven't seen all the details, but I believe that the employer was demanding the college support staff would have a 12-month probationary period when they start a job, as opposed to 6 months. So to draw the line against that kind of move, which just puts more and more power in the hands of bosses, mm-hmm. I think is a really good, you know, a hopeful thing. But it's taking place in a climate which isn't very good for workers.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you analyze the use of governments to use back-to-work legislations, which has been used recently with CUPW? And how do you see these legislations impacting, you know, the strength of unions?
Okay, so yeah, it was used against the postal workers, and I should also mention it was threatened against the Air Canada workers, mm-hmm. who accepted a deal before they were legislated back to work. It was also threatened in Saskatchewan this summer against crop insurance workers, where the premier actually wrote an open letter saying, if you don't end this strike and go back to work, I'm going to legislate you back to work. Mm-hmm. Open letters like that. So this is worrying. This is not new. This has been happening in Canada since the 70s. And, you know, well, before that too, but commonly since the 70s, and it really is a boon, an aid for employers. Certainly, in the case of Canada Post, the employer locked workers out, which gave the federal Tory government the excuse to say, "Oh well, we need the postal service back. We're going to legislate an end to this dispute." And then the legislation was written in a very clever way to ensure, or not. To stack the deck in such a way as to make it very, very likely that some of the employer's key demands would be reflected in the new contract that would be awarded by the arbitrator appointed to resolve the unresolved issues. So what this is doing is continuing the trend towards basically taking away the ability of workers to exercise the rights that they have in law. I mean, the law says that unionized workers have the right to strike, but then if you actually attempt to use that right and to do it in a way that's effective, as the postal workers were trying to do, and as the Air Canada workers were trying to do, then here you have the state stepping in and saying, no, we're going to make an exception, and you're in fact going to be denied the right that's there. So it's a further weakening of the minimal democratic right to withdraw your labor. You know, the right to strike is extremely restricted in Canada by law. It's very, very tightly circumscribed in terms of when and for what purposes you can strike, but these kinds of interventions with back-to-work legislation are, you know, about even undermining that there. And again, that's only going to be an aid to employers in enforcing through the kinds of demands for rollbacks that they're pushing.
Mm-hmm. One of the calls you've made in your book is for more radicalism within workers' movements, not just within unions, but the general working class movement. And I'm wondering if you can define what you mean by radicalism, and how can one expect radicalism when there seems to be sort of a low popularity of unions right now, and also you know, the state using back to work legislations. What does radicalism look like in this time of anti worker sentiment?
Well, by radicalism, I'm talking about the kinds of goals that unions and community-based workers' organizations are trying to achieve. So in an age where our expectations have been lowered by 3 decades of employers and governments mostly getting their own way with the neoliberal agenda, radicalism, there are many different forms that it can take. It can mean not simply trying to defend what we already have, but actually putting forward positive demands for change. For unions, that can mean demands, for example, for job creation, and for employment equity in terms of how jobs are awarded by employers, to try to actually suggest that people should have the right to a decent job, and to try to redress inequalities in the distribution of decent jobs. You can try to, in terms of radicalism, take on issues of employer control, trying to actually fight for flexibility for workers rather than flexibility as defined by management. So, as opposed to simply trying to get better wages and benefits, you can actually try to put demands on the table which make some kinds of inroads in, even if they're small inroads, in employers' ability to dominate workers on the job and create a little more space for working people. I mean, it needs to be, of course, tailored to each situation, but public sector unions can try to put forward demands about the services that they deliver. I think that's a really important thing. The idea of public sector workers not just negotiating for their wages and benefits and so on, but also saying, well, as for example, as teachers, putting forward demands about class size and composition, as healthcare workers, putting forward demands about, say, nurse-patient ratios, how many nurses you need per, or how many patients per nurse. These kinds of things that actually have an impact on the services that are delivered, and of course on the quality of the work that people are able to do. Those for unions, those are some workplace demands. But radicalism also means addressing other aspects of people's lives off the job. Mm-hmm. So whether that means raising demands, and building public campaigns and mobilizations in defense of public services. And for the creation of jobs in the public sector, for ecological change, such as hard caps on and emission reductions, so real ecological reforms from an ecological justice perspective. There's a whole range of different kinds of demands. I mean, the demand for status for all, which has been raised by migrant justice organizations. I mean, these are some of the kind of concrete radical demands that can be put forward and fought for, not just in bargaining between unions and employers, but also by unions and other workers' organizations in the community mobilizing to put demands on the state.
Mm-hmm. And you've written about the relationship between, you kind of make a distinction between working class movement organizations such as, worker action centers known as Illegal, migrant farm worker, justice organizations that, aren't organized as unions. What is the relationship between these organizations and the broader labor movement?
Okay, yeah, so what I try to argue in the book is that we need to think about a broad working class movement that's made up of both unions and some of those kinds of organizations that you mentioned. Then that's the importance of thinking about them that way is because often people on both sides of that line don't think about themselves as being in a common movement, and for understandable reasons, because they're different organizations, they don't often work together, and where there are often tensions. There's both a lack of understanding sometimes, but there's also power relations that are at play. And so I think those are some of the challenges that are there. So there is a broad movement, but it's a divided movement and a very uneven kind of a movement. I forgot exactly how you phrased the question, but can you just pose it again?
What is the relationship between non-union working class movement organizations and the labor movement?
Right. So between non-union organizations and the unions, it varies depending on where we're talking about and what organization. But often, non-union organizations are not recognized as being working class organizations, working class movement organizations by union officials, who often think of themselves as the exclusive representatives of working people. And there's often many of the community-based organizations tend to be more radical than many of the union officials, and there's a potential political difference there, which can lead to friction. There's also control issues. where it's one thing to put out a joint statement with another organization, but are you actually really going to sit down at a common table and plan together on a basis which is egalitarian, you know, where it's not just a question of union officials dictating how things are going to be because they have the numbers and the money, often because they're much larger organizations in most cases. You know, so often it's a difficult kind of a relationship, and there's been all sorts of all sorts of friction, and there are some more hopeful examples, of course, as well, where individual union locals with more progressive local activists and local officers have actually built more the kind of relationships that I think need to be built as between labor and community activists working together in common cause and actually learning about each other's issues. So there are positive examples like that, but if you look at and I'm sure people in Toronto who are active in some of these organizations could give examples of the friction and the difficulties that are there. So I think the underlying problem, one of the underlying problems at least, is that there are very few radical activists within unions, and so the radical left within unions is weak and dispersed, and therefore it's not well articulated and linked up with radical activists who are involved in community-based work. And of course, people who are involved in community organizing know that there are not that many radicals doing community organizing either. So the fact that the weakness of the radical left in general means that the people who would be best positioned to build those kinds of alliances, because they have a broad vision of working class struggle that's not just about unions, are often not from not very many of them, and often not well organized, and often very busy doing work on particular projects, and so it's hard to come together and build networks and organizations that cross those different institutions, across unions, and across different community-based organizations.
Mm-hmm. And you've written a great deal in your book about sort of the problems with union bureaucracy and union leadership, and in some unions. And I'm wondering, overall, when you're talking about reinventing, the workers' movement, do you see, what is the role, I guess, of the traditional union structure? Like, do you think that structure can be saved, or do we need to start envisioning something different in terms of, membership-based workers' organizations?
Again, crucial question, and I do not claim to have a crystal ball about the future of the workers' movement. Publisher has used publicity for the book, which makes a claim that the book doesn't. In terms of, I don't claim to have any recipe or anything like that to offer. This is something. The answer to that question is going to be given by people themselves, working people themselves, as they try to find more effective ways of resisting. And we can look back into the past. If you look at the 60s and the 70s, you saw within unions. Certain number in Canada, even more in the States, rank-and-file caucuses, that is, groups of workers who came together to fight for a more militant and democratic kind of unionism, because they were running up against entrenched officials that were really obstacles to their struggles. And so that was an attempt to create a new form of organization that would be more effective. What our future, effort's going to be like, it's hard to say, because we're at a point right now where there's not a lot of that happening, and people are often so on the defensive that it's and reactive that there haven't been there have been some important examples, which I try to document in the book, but not that many in terms of new forms of organizing. But it's one thing that I think is very clear is that unions, unions are there, right? Unions are there as mass organizations, and so trying to pretend that they're not there, trying to just kind of ignore them and trying to start from scratch somewhere else, I don't think is going to get far. The question is, workers who are unionized are going to need to, go through and beyond the experience of unions as they exist right now, rather than somehow trying to just, people are not in large numbers going to just leave them and go and start something else. Mm-hmm. I just don't think the history of social movements suggests that isn't usually what happens. So if people go through the experience of trying to change unions and having that really fail, then, it would be interesting to see what happens. But I think we can expect to see both efforts to do things differently inside unions, you know, maybe there'll be a new attempt to create caucuses or independent networks that allow union members to act independently of the official structures, which I think is the key point. Mm-hmm. And there, I think, will also be attempts to create new organizations outside of unions. It was an interesting example in Victoria that I tried to document in the book about the Community Solidarity Coalition, which existed about almost a decade ago in the high point of the fight against the BC Liberals, which brought together both rank-and-file union activists and community activists. It's an interesting example of a kind of a fight-back coalition that did actually have both grassroots union and community involvement. I'm not suggesting it was perfect, but it was significant as a certain kind of organization. So, this is a long-winded way of talking around that question, I guess, and saying that I think new forms of organizing are necessary, but what they're going to be like, I think is something that's going to be decided on the ground by workers and not by what small numbers of radicals, let alone university-based researchers, say.
All right. My final question is, looking within Canada or internationally, what kind of labor organizing or workers' movement do you find inspirational?
Oh, I think there's all sorts of inspiration that's there. Whether you look at, in New Zealand, there's a small independent union that's been organizing low-wage workers that's quite inspirational. In France, there's a whole federation, which has just recently broken 100,000 members, called Solidaire, which brings together very militant, very democratic, and quite radical unions. And, there are a number of other kind of similar organizations in Europe. In India, there's the... I believe the organization is called New Trade Union Initiative. Those are significant organizations, and in Latin America, a whole range of different kinds of organizations. And I guess what these have in common is that they are all worker-run, worker-controlled, highly democratic organizations, which see themselves as fighting not just for their members, but also on behalf of and in solidarity with the rest of the working class, and in not seeing that they themselves are the only organization of the movement, but they're working in close relationships with other organizations. So whether you look at the best examples of in Bolivia of militant unions and indigenous peoples organizing together, or if you look at the movements in France of the Solidaire unions working with the movements of the sans-papiers, undocumented workers, and other groups of oppressed people who are self-organizing. In all these kinds of places, you see a different kind of workers' movement emerging, and, of course, often alongside of traditional organizations. So I think internationally, the situation for the working class is not good. It's deteriorating, but there are places where people are building organizations which are have much more potential, and they're up against big threats. But at least with those kinds of organizations, they have the possibility of inspiring people and showing a practice that a different kind of working class movement is possible. So I think these kinds of organizations are worth finding out more about. We can't simply transplant models from other conditions to the ones we have here in Canada and expect them to work, but if we want to understand the situation we find ourselves in here in a global perspective, it's really important to step outside our narrow Canadian frame of looking at things and try to look at some of these kinds of organizations and in surprising places, like in China, where there have been a whole rash of strikes as workers try to find ways of organizing outside of the official unions, which are really just an arm of the one-party state. Mm-hmm. And in other places, we can see these new shoots but I call in the book seeds of hope. I think there are a few of these seeds of hope in Canada, but there are certainly more of them in other places.